All right, boys, just listen up for a sec. Can you hear that?
Mm-hmm.
How does that sound make you feel? Give me some adjectives.
It's nice. It's kind of like reassuring. Steady.
That sounds like a very accurate kind of... I really like the sound of that mechanism.
It's very precise, isn't it?
Yeah. It also makes me feel like I should be somewhere that I'm not. Like I'm in a rush or something.
What have
I
forgotten?
Kind of running late. But it does sound very nice.
I think all of that is very valid, boys. But let me tell you, this is the sound of a British-designed mechanical timepiece from the talented team at Marlowe Watch Company, sponsors of this episode. And with Marlowe, each collection is influenced by a historical story of inspiring human endeavour. Now, I've spent some time at their HQ recently because, well, I'm curious about mechanical timekeeping and also how things work. And I can tell you that there is so much very pleasing attention to detail that goes into each and every watch design. Now, these guys are serious about their watches, and you can tell by looking at some of the watch reviews online. I mean, the words quality and value come up time and again. Visit marlowewatchcompany.com to see for yourself. Marlowe Watch Company, time well spent, which I also like to think could be said for this podcast.
I don't necessarily feel that you should tell people what they should and shouldn't do, but maybe you could just tell them what the reality of food production is and then they can make their own decisions.
Very good.
Wise words. Wise words. Thank you, James. And it's good to get passionate, isn't it?
Sorry, having told not to be moral, I'm always so preachy about stuff like that.
Don't apologise, James. We love it. We love it. We're back with the second instalment of our botany episode, exploring another three sketches on plants with celebrated and, let's be frank, very entertaining botanist James Wong, imparting logical truth bombs like this.
If you have a limited amount of income, the most possible expensive way to get hold of food is to grow it yourself.
No need to mess about with an intro then. Back to the conversation with James. And the next sketch we're going to talk about is the hungry gap. Jono, what's the hungry gap? Why is this something you wanted to communicate through sketch explanations?
Yeah, the hungry gap was, I was interested, like there's obviously a movement and it makes a ton of sense to eat local. And so it's like, okay, well, what grows locally at different times of the year? In my mind, you know, which was completely naive, I was like, okay, well, not much. You know, summer is amazing, loads of stuff's coming to harvest, winter not so much, and it will probably increase until then. So I was quite surprised to learn that actually there are a lot of plants that you can eat in winter. You end up eating a lot of the same ones potentially, but actually as you come into spring, this is in sort of temperate latitudes, like, and obviously relevant for the UK, that period of April, May, June, that you have this period where the winter crops are not as productive, but you haven't yet got to the summer crops. And so there's this name for that period called the hungry gap, where actually there's much less stuff you can harvest in this climate where you've got. And so if you're trying to only eat local, or, you know, things that are grown, let's say in the UK, it's a harder bit to bridge in that spring thing. Whereas my immediate reaction is, oh, it's getting sunnier, it's getting nicer, of course there's going to be more food. But that's actually not the case. So that's what the hungry gap was.
I think the hungry gap should be taught in schools for a number of reasons. So I think it's great to talk to engineers about this, because plants are basically just living solar panels, except there's a lag. Yeah. Exactly as you described. So they're capturing energy from the sun, but it takes them a while to do that. And in winter, they're storing all of this energy as a battery, usually in root vegetables. So that's why a lot of the things in winter are roots. Or they're storing them in leaves. So they're grabbing hold of those calories they had in the summer and, like, putting them down in a form that they can hide away to live off for themselves. That means if you're a human that wants to come along and eat something, winter's not too bad a time, because you've got all these calories that are stored up. By spring, they've run out of it. But I think it has implications on world history. It has implications in trade, but it also has implications in terms of just basic nutrition. So I'm often hearing people say things like, you know, in the past, our diets were so much better. No, they really, really were not. There is a lot of nostalgia when it comes to food. People lived horrible, miserable, and very short lives. We now live, apart from maybe the last 20-ish years, in a season, in a condition that we've never had as humanity, with the most plentiful, most affordable and safest food supply. That has changed quite recently, but for a long period of time, the trajectory was going up. And I think it's important to understand that, you know, like I've often heard people say, for example, using this appeal to nature narrative, that you shouldn't eat fruit. Fruit is really high in sugar and therefore terrible for you. And in our deep evolutionary past, when we were really healthy and had lovely lives, fruit was only available for a short period in summer. I'm like, summer's the one time you probably wouldn't have got fruit for. Fruit was available in temperate latitudes, like apples, for a huge proportion of the year. Mm. I remember I was wandering around my local supermarket in June, and there's a lady who was really kicking off. She was furious about why there were New Zealand apples on the shelves of British supermarkets and why they weren't British. I was like, yeah, it's June. You harvest them in like September. Yeah. You can store them for a really long period of time. You can probably, with, you know, all the carbon induced refrigeration and modified atmosphere, probably just about get them to June. But there's a good reason for that. So that if we were to teach kids about that, we would be able to teach them to be a little bit more literate in terms of where their food comes from. Mm. And that sometimes, you know, a lot of the faddy promises that diet gurus show you, which can we know can be really damaging, both in terms of that their advice doesn't make sense, but also because their advice is often tied up with morality. That's, you know, one of the many contributing factors towards eating disorders. If we were to tell them where food came from and how it works and how plants work, they would have a bit of a bullshit detector against that. Mm. You might have to bleep that out.
No, we're all right. We're good. We're right in your wheelhouse here, James. This is ethnobotany, isn't it? This is right in there.
It's a really good point about at school as well, because I was a bit embarrassed with my kids in supermarket in January, and I was like, you know, what would you like? And they're like, strawberries, raspberries, you know. And it's like, okay, well, you know, they so we went over, and of course Sainsbury's had them, and they'd come from Chile or Egypt or something like that. Yes. So therefore they were like £5 for a very small punnet, and they just sort of went to grab them because, you know, strawberries are strawberry. I was like, whoa, those are, you know, and why are they so expensive, Daddy? It's, well, because they've come thousands of miles, because it's January. You can't just grow these sort of things all year round in this country. And I was a bit embarrassed with my lack of education to my kids that I felt that. But then when I saw John's sketch of the Hunger Gap, I was like, oh, I'm not sure I really realised that either. So there's still a lot to learn.
You shouldn't feel guilty about that, because you just taught them that. And you know, partially, they're going to be more expensive at the time of year because of that import. But also, we also know that in general, you know, flavor is subjective, but flavor and nutrient compounds can be reduced as a result of that transport, because growers have to get fruit that will survive that level of transport. So they're breeding for things that are harder, that are not necessarily sweeter, that are basically will survive being bashed around. And in that breeding process, flavor is not really a marker. Appearance often is.
Yeah.
Size and durability is.
Yes.
Yeah. No one's paying for, like, you tasting them. You know, once you go home. So, you know, if your kids really want them, you buy them once and then ask them if they can really notice the difference. Are they rock hard? Were they really worth it?
So societally, are we saying that by better education around the hungry gap, that we should be much more accepting of what foods should be available at different points of the year and adjust our diet to that?
I don't think there's a should about that. I think, you know, I try not to be morally about food.
We also try not to be moral on the podcast as well. Not morally up on our pedestals. We try not to.
So this happened during the pandemic, right? One of the things that really upset me, I was on Twitter and I saw a whole bunch of people, and I don't mean individuals, I mean companies, saying, you know, if you're worried about food security, here's our home food security kit, where you have, like, you know, some compost, two packets of seed, and a big raised bed. And you had all of these people who would write below it, you know, my family will not go hungry. And I kind of thought, pandemic or not, if you have a limited amount of income, the most possible expensive way to get hold of food is to grow it yourself. I'm saying this as someone who, like, I earn my living by telling people how to grow plants. But I think it's to know how, like one of those growing kits, let's say you had all the skills in the world and all the attention in the world to be able to know how to do all of that stuff. You're still going to get probably 3 meals of carrots out of that growing kit. Mm. If you were to buy them, that would probably cost in a discount supermarket less than a fiver.
Yeah.
Whereas the kit probably cost you a couple of hundred quid. And I think it's important that we, not to tell people what they should and shouldn't eat, but to be able to tell them, you know, what can and can't be done, and also to value what farmers do. Mm-hmm. Farmers have done this miracle of being able to provide the cheapest food really in the history of our species. And how amazing that is and how we should celebrate that. And I don't necessarily feel that you should tell people what they should and shouldn't do, but maybe you could just tell them what the reality of food production is, and then they can make their own decisions.
Very good.
Wise words. Wise words. Thank you, James. And it's good to get passionate, isn't it?
Sorry, having told not to be moral, I'm always so preachy.
don't apologize, James. We love it. We love it. Right, I'm gonna keep moving us along because we could sit and talk around for ages. Because James,
do not
apologize. It's absolutely fascinating, and we are all learning. There's so much nodding and smiling going on. On to the next sketch, though. Phoenix trees.
Yes.
I'd never heard of this. I saw the sketch. I got it straight away. That's the beauty of Sketch Explanations. Jono, tell us about what a phoenix tree is. And you're very careful about this in the sketch as well, and how it's different to a nurse log. And I'll put the sketch for nurse logs in the podcast description down below as well, because they could look similar.
They could look almost identical. How would you change the drawing around that? That's hard to do.
There is a drawing of a nurse log. Oh. as a separate one. But yeah, it looks very similar. It looks very, very similar. But they are different. And I mean, I'll just be really quick. So I learned about phoenix tree from a sign when I was out on a walk, and I was like, oh, there's a phoenix tree over here. This is what a phoenix tree is.
It was signposted, what, in a national park or something?
There was a little information board which talked about phoenix trees as a thing, and then it said there is one over there, and we went over there, and they're also brilliant to sort of play on as well, which is lovely. But basically a phoenix tree, I mean, a phoenix is, you know, from the mythical phoenix, a bird that dies and then rises again, and then dies and rises again.
A phoenix from the flames.
Exactly, or from the, you know, rising from the ashes. And so typically where I've seen phoenix trees is they've been blown over. A big tree has been blown over and most of their roots are now disconnected, but some of them have stayed connected. And so this tree is now lying, big tree lying horizontally, but has stayed alive. And what happens, which is sort of remarkable, is like hanging on to life, is that the branches which were before that pointing sideways, some of them are now pointing straight up. And if it lies there long enough, this big tree, it keeps feeding it. These side branches essentially become their own trees. And more remarkably, this is what I learned, is that some of those trees, which were branches, can then actually put down their own roots sort of halfway along the tree, which is fascinating.
Yeah. That's the point that blew my mind. Yeah, that what were branches now suddenly start growing roots. How do they know to do that?
So trees are, like, I mean, I love plants because they're way cooler than animals in, like, pretty much every way. And yet people don't realize this. There's like 500 animal scientists for every one plant scientist, Boo. Which is kind of, oh, we know who the cool and popular group is. But I mean, plants are fascinating because they don't have to follow the same rules as animals. Mm-hmm. So that you don't really see big extinction events. We sort of do, but not in the same way that we see, you know, when the dinosaurs were wiped out, not all of the plants were wiped out. In fact, most of them carried on. And in the animal fossil record, you see these like wipeouts, and plants can do things like be blown up and split into pieces and then grow from individual tiny fractions. You can chop a tree up into 1,000 pieces and each bit will grow. You can't do that with mammals. You can bury seeds for tens of thousands of years or freeze them in a glacier and they'll still come back. You can chop a tree down and it will still grow. And basically, plants, unlike mammals or unlike most animals, retain their stem cells throughout life. So they're undifferentiated cells that could basically turn into anything at a moment's notice. We have those in as animals in our very early part of our life, but then they become fixed and a skin cell can only become another skin cell. With trees, an undifferentiated cell could become a leaf, it could become a flower, it could become a root. It just has to have the right stimuli. And the stimuli, there are a few different things. So plants can tell which way is up. So they can tell roots have to go down usually. Leaves have to go up, so it can tell from that. It can tell from water. It can tell from, like, so which area is more moist and which area is less moist. It can tell from light, so which way is up is often where the light source is, but it can also move. Let's say there's a big tree above a tree. A tree can move out and move around that to reach the light. That's why if you have a house plant by a window, it stretches towards the window. So plants can detect lots of information about the world around them, and they can essentially make decisions into changing their body structures to match that.
Hence making the decision to grow roots.
Yeah, and they don't have a fixed body plan. We have fixed body plans that are symmetrical. A plant can just chuck out leaves wherever it wants to, essentially, or most of them can anyway. And that's the really cool thing. I think that there's something about resilience and survivability in that. But what I want to know is, Jono, what's a nurse log? I love it when engineers tell botanists about plants. This is great.
So I learned about nurse logs, and I don't know, maybe they happen all over the world, but I learned about them in the forests of the Pacific Northwest and California, where you have these very tall conifer and pine forests and dead straight trees. They're going way up, and what happens is that you get these really, and some of them are huge trees, and they can be really old, and they can make the forest floor quite dark as well. So it's actually quite difficult for things to grow along the forest floor. You get a few ferns, for example, which I've got in the sketch. And then what will happen when a giant tree like that dies, maybe there's a storm, or it's fallen by lightning, or maybe even a fire, but let's say it just gets old, it falls over. Usually it will clear out this big space where suddenly there's some light coming down to the forest floor. But it's also so big that actually, you know, birds might sit on it and leave droppings which have seeds on it. Seeds might fall on this trunk. And it provides above the very base of the forest, where there actually is some low plants, a really nice sort of little nursery place for new trees to grow. And so instead of growing straight on the forest floor, they grow along the trunk where they happen to take root. And so the actual original tree has died, but you get the trees growing from the trunk. And of course, as you do that, you end up with like a really straight line of trees. And there are cases also, which I have seen, I think it was in the Olympic rainforest, where the original tree is essentially eventually decayed away. And you just have, you know, it's very unusual to see dead straight lines in that way in nature, particularly with plants, I think. But you have this perfect, right, perfect straight line of trees. And so, yeah, you're very right. It's extremely similar in terms of a sketch, but I suppose it's different in the mechanism by which it happens.
Definitely. I mean, you convey that really well. When I'm wandering around, I was actually wandering around very on brand a forest just yesterday, plantation forest, and it is quite hard to tell whether it's a phoenix tree, whether it's a tree that's fallen over and then some of the branches have sprouted and then sprung up in a perfect line. Or if basically when you have a fallen tree in a forest and it starts to rot, it's basically a big block of compost that doesn't have any competing weeds in it, that holds loads of water and it's raised up in the light. So it's a perfect place for these new seeds to get competitive advantage and generate. But what you see is exactly the same. And the older it is, the more rotted and broken down. Because I'm boring, spend a good 5 minutes trying to wonder if, you know, which was which. So it's kind of cool, the natural world. These two completely different phenomena look almost identical.
Is it particular types of forests? I mean, Johnny, you talked about the forests of the Pacific Northwest there. Is that particularly common there? Or could it be anywhere?
The classic example is the Pacific Northwest. I wonder now why that might be the case. The Pacific Northwest has a sort of Cornish, west of Scotland, temperate rainforest environment. So it's even temperature and loads of rainfall. And that may help create the really wet, soggy environment in rotting wood that can really facilitate that growing. I think if it was in a drier desert environment, there wouldn't be enough rainfall to soak the log to create that. I actually don't know, but it is a very specifically Pacific Northwest is where you constantly see the best images of it. The thing about plants, you think you know them, and then suddenly you get a question you can't answer.
I'll tell you what, though, talking about the survival instinct of plants again there, James. I've said it before, I'll say it again. Plants are badass.
Yeah. I mean, if there was a competition for survivability of plants and animals, I know which team I'm picking.
Team Green.
Team Green.
I was never picked for any of the teams in PE, so I'm the opposite. I'm picking the side that's winning because I know on my own I'm not going to make it.
James is a botanist glory hunter. Let's move on to the that's final me. Sketch. Grow your own fresh air. Where do we want to start with this one? Because I know Jono, as the creator of the sketch, and James, you probably both got a lot to say about it. But Jono, you explain first, because you've done this sketch and then you've seen more about it.
And also since been educated by one of the things about putting things out on the internet is people tell you whether things are right or wrong, which is, but anyway, I mean,
which is a good thing.
The sketch, which is a lovely, it's a lovely idea about how to grow your own fresh air, which was a very short TED talk by a guy called Kamal Mittal, and in which he describes how they use lots and lots of plants in a New Delhi office park, essentially to try and the air in the city wasn't clean, and so they wanted to make the air inside as clean of chemicals and as fresh to breathe as possible. And so they filled it with all these plants, and in his talk he covers a few different types of plants which have different functions, which is what he says about how they operate. And I think as a sketch, it was really, I think it's really interesting. It's a really appealing concept, and it's a lovely idea to fill a house or a building with plants and think that you're now breathing fresh Agreed. Air created by these plants, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's, plants make oxygen. That's what we breathe. So we're going to fill it up and we're going to make our own air. And so that's what he explains in the talk. And I think as a sketch of what he said in the talk, I think that's fair. Now, a number of people have since mentioned to me that, that it's not necessarily exactly true, and there are better ways to make your own fresh air. But I'll let James tell me about the nuances of this sketch and maybe the, I don't know, I think twists and turns of people figuring this out.
You're so nice and supportive, Rob. Like smiling, helping him along. I'm going to come and ruin it for you. okay, here's the thing. Plants do clean the air. That is true. Like on a global context, and even if in a big outdoor context, we know that plants can remove particulates from the air, for example, so solid bits of pollution get trapped in their leaves. And of course, plants photosynthesize. They're constantly taking in carbon dioxide, which we're breathing out, and converting it into oxygen for us to be able to breathe in. We even know that their roots can absorb toxins. So plants like sunflowers are often used on contaminated land.
Wow.
To draw up heavy metals through their roots in concentrated into their branches. They're removed off-site and burnt, and then those ashes can be disposed of as toxic waste. But then the soil is... So plants do that.
Right.
Whether houseplants do it is a different thing. Now, in the 80s, there were some really famous trials run by NASA. And what they were trying to figure out is as space... stations get further and further away from Earth in a planned future, what's going to happen is they're not going to be able to get supplies sent back to and from Earth. So what they need to have is some way of creating new spare parts. And wouldn't it be great if plants could do that? So currently they have air filters that get rid of, you know, toxins in the air and then make the air pure and breathable. And plants do that on Earth, and plants are self-healing. So wouldn't it be great if we could do that? And there was a series of experiments set up where they created these tiny little chambers. They shoved a large plant in this perfectly sealed chamber and measured its effects on the air. And what they found is that they did reduce lots of the contaminants from air and produce lots of oxygen. And that was really the only really solid trial. It was kept around for years. I've reported on it and sort of parroted it as if it must be relevant because there weren't a huge amount of other trials. What we now know, according to the much better, more solid trials, does one of these hermetically sealed chambers really translate to the reality of living in a living room? Not so much, partially because rooms are not hermetically sealed. So constantly air is moving around in the building, underneath doors, in cracks in windows, and it's moving around a lot more than you might think. And plants don't actually produce that much. So firstly, you would need the room to be sealed. And to mimic the experiment, you would have to have so many plants in your room that you had no furniture and would have to constantly be stood in one place and couldn't move to replicate the density of plants in that environment. One trial basically figured out you would have to have 500 average size plants. Don't know what on earth that means. Per square meter of apartment to replicate the same benefit of cracking a window now and then. For plants to be able to draw carbon out of the atmosphere, to draw carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, what they do is they convert it into the carbon of their bodies. So to be able to really be doing a lot of that, there has to be a lot of physical plant matter. Like, I'm almost 100 kilos. I'm kicking out a lot of CO2. Plants, to have enough plants to do that, you'd have to have several hundred kilos of plants. And that's actually very difficult if you think about the weight of your average houseplant. So plants, houseplants, we know that they have loads of benefits in many, many ways. Just purifying the air really isn't one of them. And opening a window now and then would do a much better job. On the planetary context, it's different. But in the living room context, it doesn't really work.
Yeah, so theoretically, there is a case, but practically, it's irrelevant. That's not going to happen. It doesn't. You can't apply it to practical life.
Correct. When you see this, there's a film called Sunshine. I'm terrible for picking holes in all the botany of any film. and they have an Asian botanist who works on a flight. And so I was instantly like, oh my God, identify, right? That's the cool job I want to have. And then I saw their oxygen garden. I was like, oh girl, Michelle Yeoh, you've got this all so wrong. So it's all tree ferns. Tree ferns put on one canopy once a year. They're one of the slowest growing plants on earth. What you need to have, if you were to have an environment like that, probably not plants, you would probably go for algae because they photosynthesize, but you could cram loads of them in tanks and water everywhere.
Nice.
And have huge amounts of algae in a small space. Ooh. But if you wanted to use plants, you'd have to go for some kind of grass, maybe bamboo, or something that grows incredibly quickly. To draw that carbon out of the air and then and lock it away in the plant tissues. But tree ferns, I mean, it's literally the worst possible, you know. Michelle Yeoh, you've got to get better.
Well, I must admit, I'm quite relieved to hear that I don't have to have mother-in-law's tongue in my bedroom, especially not six of them.
No.
I've said the names of plants. You mentioned at the beginning how a lot are sort of Latin names and very complicated, but also some of the names are just brilliant. Mother-in-law's tongue. I'm sure you probably know the history of that name.
I mean, it's because they're pointy and sharp, basically. So it's kind of, it's
that simple.
Nowadays, us work people call it something like a snake plant. There's been a lot of changing of traditional names of plants because some of them are very Victorian. Like that is the soft end of some of the renamed common plants that we've had before. But I always find it, because I often only know the scientific name, not the common name, because there are so many common names. And I can get that people worry about the Latin, but I feel that they shouldn't, because, for example, people think, oh, well, to tell kids about plants, you can't ever say their Latin name. I was like, yeah, because kids never hear about Tyrannosaurus and Stegosaurus. Yeah, they can't possibly pronounce Velociraptor. They're all Latin names. And I think maybe it's because of pronunciation, but Latin's a dead language, and botanical Latin isn't actually even Latin. It's this weird mix of ancient Greek, some Latin, there's like Polish, there's like Chinese. There's there's Norwegian. There's a whole bunch of loan words in it. There's no correct pronunciation. The whole point of it is it's a international language that anyone can use, like Esperanto. Oh. So basically, say it how the hell you want, and people will understand you and don't worry about it.
Yeah, good tip. Good tip for life, generally, actually.
Unless you're going to dig up a Roman soldier and reanimate them, and then they wouldn't understand botanical Latin, and if they did. There would be so much regional accent variation in the Roman Empire that however you say it would probably be correct in one part of the Roman Empire. So just don't worry about it.
Listen, I will round things off. Is there anything else anyone wants to quickly add before we finish off this week's episode?
James, can I ask one small thing? You mentioned that plants can reduce crime. I was intrigued about that.
Yes.
They're badass, Jono. They've got fists. No.
So here is the tricky thing with some of the research that we've had about what plants do in an environment. So we previously have thought that plants, like living near a park, for example, was associated with higher birth weight, was lower crime, with all these kind of amazing things. And no one stopped to think about when the original research was being done with plants, is they basically just looked at statistics and correlated those with parks. No one stopped to think that rich people live near parks. So of course there's going to be lower crime and higher birth rates because those people have access to better healthcare and better opportunities in life in general. But we now know that it's actually more complicated than that. So there have been intervention studies, not just correlation studies. So an intervention study basically sets up an experiment where it changes the parameters of a situation. So there have been studies where they've planted plants in some inner city blocks and spent money greening up certain areas and haven't done that with areas that are quite close by. And we do know that antisocial behavior, according to a limited number of trials, goes down in these areas. We also know that things like anxiety and stress are reduced in those areas. So it stands to reason. We know that this appears to be a cause of an effect relationship going on, and it may be just to do with reducing that. It may be due to things like when you improve someone's the area and the area is cared for, people are more likely to have a sense of identity with that area and start to invest and manage that
a bit
area.
More agency.
Whereas if they don't they feel exactly, then you know you might end up with people doing a bit more neighborhood watch type behavior, and that may control it. So it is relatively limited. But it's pretty solid, whereas before it was, you know, trying to find correlation when it's just causation rather when it's just correlation is quite tricky. But the more recent studies have shown it's probably quite solid.
Do you know what? From my perspective, as you talk through that, it kind of strikes me as if it looks right, if it smells right, if it tastes right, it's probably right.
Yeah, I mean, the challenge, though, is always trying to make sure that you can show you're working at and demonstrate it, particularly if you're a botanist, because you're kind of already sold on it. So you're constantly having to check yourself to see, because sometimes and very often in the world of plants, what's intuitive isn't always the case. So I really, really wanted to believe that plants clean the air because I feel better around them. I feel I can breathe better. I'm more relaxed. When you actually look at the cold, hard data, sadly, you have to admit that's the one thing that they don't do, at least in a room. So it is important to try and, you know, as much as I love plants and want to be on the team that they do everything, you've got to try and maintain that objectivity.
Yeah.
There's one sketch, one of my favorite ones. I did it ages and ages ago, and it's really simple. It just says everyone's a geek about something, and it has a bunch of people doing all these different things with a big heart above their head. And, you know, it could be bird watching or hiking or reading or ballet or football, like you mentioned, or video games or whatever. When I was actually doing my first draft for the book, which is coming out, my title originally was going to be Everyone's a Geek About Something, because that's, for me, in a way, that's part of like the joy of doing Sketchpanations is sharing all these fascinating bits. And it obviously we've touched on some botany related ones today, but there's all sorts of things which are fascinating about the world, and I just love how you've taken all of these things and just added so many interesting layers to it. I love it. Thank you.
Right,
we could have stopped the show at onions when you explained the onions. That was it. That's done.
Thank you so much for coming on to the show, James. We've learned so much. You know, I've got a number of actions I'm going to be taking. James, just out of interest, what is on the horizon for you over the next coming weeks, coming months? Anything we should be keeping an eye out for?
I am. What am I doing? I'm working at Chelsea Flower Show soon. I write for New Scientist, doing more educational videos on Instagram, that kind of thing. Spending time looking at the plants in car parks, taking photos, looking very dodgy.
James, I saw your indoor gardening masterclass. Looks fantastic. My wife, this is a...
Oh yeah, I should probably talk about that.
Yeah, go on.
I've been working on an online course to tell people how to grow plants, because I think, you know, for me, the fact that I live with 500 houseplants tells you all you need to know about the state of my mental health. Plants, we know from a huge body of evidence how important they can be for your mental and physical health. And if I can share just 1% of what plants give me with everyone else, but be able to do it in a way that they don't have to feel fearful of, they don't have to worry about messing up, that they can be, you know, have their hand held throughout it and see kind of almost in real time how I put a terrarium together. Because when we filmed it, we literally filmed me, you know, it wasn't the highlights. Like, three cameras were on me while I made the terrarium in real time. So every messy bit is sort of shown in full glorious Technicolor, so you can't miss anything out. That's one of the things I'm working on the moment. I've been working on recently that I'm most proud of.
And is that the indoor gardening masterclass?
Yes, from Create Academy.
That it looked absolutely brilliant. It's my wife's birthday coming up, and I think she.
I'm sure I can get you a code for that.
Wow. Well, it looks brilliant, and I think, you know, the things that you've made and the videos about it looks absolutely fantastic. And I'd love her to be making those sort of things for the house. Yes, please.
I can see Tom's brain working. Yeah. I can see it. It's happening. Listen, everybody, you can follow James's antics up online and on social media. You can look for Botany Geek up on Instagram. That's probably the best place, is it, James, for your social media activities?
Yeah, that's the best place.
And what's your website where all the details of the academy?
So if you go to jameswong.co.uk, you have full links to the Create Academy course, but that's also on Instagram. Probably Instagram is the best place because it's always updated.
Lovely. And James is Botany Geek up on Instagram.
That's right.
Thank you so much. Thank you also to you, our wonderful listeners. I hope there's some new stuff in there for you to digest. Again, pun intended. Let us know. Email us on hello@sketchplanations.com. We'll be back almost immediately with this week's postbag. But for now, thank you. Go well and stay well. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Cheers, everyone.
And just like that, I am back. It's just me again this week to go through the postbag from quite a lot of your correspondence. As this is part two and we've got a bit of time, let's indulge a little bit. So, where to begin? We had a number of messages from people confirming that that they're unfazed, shall we say, by the new fortnightly episode regime. So that's nice. In fact, at Billy from Toronto said it's his new go-to every 2 weeks podcast. Great stuff. Thank you, Billy. And so on to the subject of the previous episode, the ambiguity of the word bi-weekly and by proxy, bi-monthly and bi-annually. Sorry, I had to say that. By proxy, bi-monthly and bi-annually. It just worked. Sorry. Yes, so the ambiguity of those words and how the word fortnightly can be a useful replacement for bi-weekly. So John Johnson Allen on LinkedIn simply says, I agree. Great. Thanks, John. At Sheila M. Wilkinson on Instagram said she got around this in the intro to her podcast by saying every other week. Yep, that's another useful term. Thank you, Sheila. At 5 minutes better on Instagram disagrees with the premise we put forward in the sketch and says it's bi-monthly. They didn't actually go on to define what frequency they use bi-monthly for, so I am a little confused with that still, but thank you for your message. What else we got? Again, on Instagram, Kelly Nichols says bi-weekly is every 2 weeks, twice a week is semi-weekly. Whatever works for you, as long as it does work and as long as you're understood. Just Keith on Instagram says bi-weekly means every other week for me, but less frequently can mean twice a week. I mean, here we go. As I live in London, I use fortnightly for bi-weekly and twice a week for other to save confusion for many. I'm not quite sure what living in London has to do with that. Interested to know more about that, Keith, whether there is some local set definition on that. If there is, I don't know about it. Thank you for your message. Alex on Instagram says, what about biannual and biennial? Which is a very good question, Alex. And I'm annoyed, actually, that I didn't pick this up with Jono and Tommy whilst we were recording this episode. Because by my understanding, biennial does have a set definition that means once every 2 years. Whereas, as discussed, biannual is ambiguous. So where fortnightly might be, as we suggested and in the sketch, fortnightly can be a really useful term without ambiguity for bi-weekly. I think biennial can be a really good term to substitute for biannual, where you do mean once every 2 years. Does that make sense? Yeah, go on. To kind of prove the point we were making, though, I put a poll up on Instagram asking if people interpreted biweekly to mean twice a week or once every 2 weeks. And without any manipulation whatsoever, I was absolutely delighted with the result. And I can't remember the exact number of people who responded to the poll, but it was you know, dozens, let's say. So the results were, drum roll please, 48% said twice a week and 52% said once every 2 weeks. QED. Okay, and to round off the postbag for this episode, on the topic of different cultural representations of timelines that Jono was telling us about in the episode on biweekly and fortnightly, we've had an email from Niall O'Donovan. He says, "Hi lads, similar to the Aboriginal use of the cardinal directions, when kayaking, we reference things relative to the clock face. So the person or the bow of the boat or the bow of the kayak is 12 o'clock and the sighted object is relative to that. So he gives an example, dolphins at 3 o'clock. Great, you know where they are. Niall goes on, he's sure there are other groups that might use this, and he suggests that could be in orienteering or in the military perhaps. And he finishes, he's really enjoying the podcast and he is also happy with the fortnightly drops. So that's great. All is well. Thank you, Niall, and thank you all for your correspondence, and thank you for listening. We would love to know what you have to say about all the stuff we talked about in this double header episode on botany with James Wong, the wonderful James Wong. So keep your correspondence coming in, either on our social media posts about it or at our email address, hello@sketchplanations.com. Until next time, though, I'll leave it there. Cheerio. All music on this podcast series is sourced from the very talented Frank Cinelli. And you can find loads more tracks at frankcinelli.com.